Welcome to the Washington Independent Review of Books podcast. My name is Susan Storer Clark, and today I'm talking with author John Boyne about his novel, A History of Loneliness. It has a, Mr. Boyne, your novel has a very striking first sentence. Good for you. I did not become ashamed of being Irish until I was well into the middle years of my life. Now, the narrator, Father Odrin Yates, he chronicles a long career as a priest and his passivity as the pedophilia scandal grows and erupts, and his haunting guilt for the ways that he's failed. Now, you are a prolific and popular writer, and your novels, both for adults and young adults, have covered a wide variety of times and places, but this is the first book you've set in your native Ireland. So why was it time to write this one?
Well, when I started writing first, as most people do, they do write about their own times, their own places. This was before I got published at first. And I found that the stories I was writing back then just were not very original. You know, they were a bit derivative of other writers. So my imagination seemed to take me to other countries, other places. And I felt that just because I'm Irish doesn't mean that I have to write about my own country. Mm-hmm. And as the years went by and the novels came out, though it did cross my mind, you know, am I never going to write about my own country? But what I felt very strongly was that I didn't want to do it unless I had a story that I really wanted to tell and I felt that only I could tell. And if that never came, so be it. I hoped it would come, but I wasn't sure that it would. And then when I had the idea for A History of Loneliness, I felt this was the one and this is how I could talk about my own country, talk about my own past, and really kind of mine my own memories for what it was like growing up in Ireland during those days and how the country has changed.
What was the kernel of the idea? How did it first come to you?
Well, there's a church in Dublin called Inchicore Church, where there's a replica of the Grotto at Lourdes. And my father goes there quite regularly to say a prayer. And he told me a story a few years ago, which I use in the book in the opening chapter, of going to that grotto one night when it was very dark, late at night, and he discovered a priest lying face down on the ground, weeping. And he also saw an elderly woman sitting in the corner of the grotto, also weeping. And for whatever reason, he believed that this woman was the mother of this priest. And the scene itself was so intimidating and so kind of scary that, you know, he just left. But he told me about it, and it made a vast impression on me. I thought, God, that's a really strange moment to come across. And I wondered why it had happened and what had led these people to that place. And something clicked in my head and I thought, this is how I will start a novel about Ireland. At the moment where society and the church is changing, the moment where we go from having complete respect and trust in the church to losing that entirely.
There's a very striking rendition of that scene in your book, too. Now, Odrin himself is a gentle, bookish man. I think we should say off the top here that he is not an abuser, but he ignores obvious hints that his best friend in the priesthood is an abuser of children, and he blames himself for all that he didn't do. But I wonder, realistically, what could he have done? What were his choices? He didn't have a lot of power.
That's true, but I think, you know, if I hadn't called the book A History of Loneliness, I would have called it Complicity. Because complicity is the word, I think, which defines that time in Irish life. Mm-hmm. It would be true to say that, you know, the majority of priests over those years were not criminals. But I think it would also be true to say that the majority of them were very suspicious of things that were going on, knew things, and didn't report them. Those who did report them might report them to their bishop, and the bishop would do nothing about it. And there's a complete conspiracy and complicity there of people being aware of crimes taking place and not doing anything to prevent them, which to my mind would make them just as culpable. Now, Odrin, of course, is a bit of a naive in his way. And it's really down to the reader to decide how much of this he has really understood, how much he's blocked out. Because a lot of elderly priests now would say that, you know, they didn't notice it, they didn't see it. But when they see priests being moved from parish to parish every year, you know, there's something unusual in that, something suspicious. And as with any job, people talk, you know, people talk to each other and gossip spreads. So I think Odrin and his kind have to hold some responsibility for the things that have happened.
The technique that you use of going back and forth across the years is very effective. And is that the way the story presented itself to you early in the process, or did you start chronologically and then start moving things around?
No, I wrote it as it appears in the book, and it's a structure I've used a couple of times before in novels and that I feel quite comfortable with. Anytime I thought about it, you know, I think if you were to write it chronologically and then mix it up, I think it would lose some, I think, bizarrely, I think it would lose some logic. That's because I don't plot out the novel in advance. I only, you know, have an idea what I want to write about, and I let the story take me where it takes me. Mm-hmm. So when I would get to the end of each section and then move to a different period of time, I would simply pick up the story from there. And so there would be things said in a chronologically later time that would not be explained to the reader until later in the book. I find that somehow I'm able to keep it all up in the air in my head and bring it together. And I mean, that's what subsequent drafts are about. That's what writing 10, 12, 15 drafts of a novel, that's how you pull it together.
Right. Now, he has two dramatic failures, actually, as I read the book. This is how I saw it. That one night in the Vatican where he fails in his duty to the Pope, and, of course, long-term with his failure to do anything about the abuse going on around him. So what do you think is the relationship between these two failures? How do you see that?
Well, I think they both affect him in different ways, but they're very important to him. That's you mentioned that he's bookish and quiet. Well, I think he's very introverted, and he's incapable of actually confronting the world, of standing up and being counted. Even very early on in the book, when his nephew wants to speak to him about the fact that that Odrin's sister, the nephew's mother, is showing signs of dementia, he just turns away. He wants to leave the house. He doesn't want to get involved. It's a fear that he has. It's an inability to actually be a man and take responsibility for things. But those two incidents, particularly, I think, what happens in the Vatican, really overshadow his life and make him not quite the person he was expecting to be, because, of course, he performs quite well in the seminary as a priest and might have been expected to go on to better things, but never really finds promotion within the church.
Mm-hmm. You show him in the 70s, early in his career, being treated by members of the public with, certainly with respect, a reverence, I thought, bordering on idolatry. But in the 2000s, he's spat upon by strangers. He has this Bible snatched out of his hand. He's even taken into custody by the police after an innocent effort. He's trying to help a five-year-old boy find his mother. And you talk to a number of priests. Are those stories based on their stories?
Yeah, a lot of them are. I mean, in the 70s and 80s parts and earlier, I mean, I grew up then, and I can remember what the attitude of my parents, of my siblings, myself, my friends, to the church was. And we treated the priests with the idolatry that you mentioned. You know, I mean, they were sanctified creatures. And if they would come into the house, I mean, it would be like, you know, it would be like the queen arriving in or something. It would, you know, you just, everything dropped. And things have changed. And the stories that I told about the later parts were pretty much all stories that priests told me, of things that, you know, being afraid to go into town wearing their priest habit because people mutter things at them under their breath. A fear of actually helping children now because you could be accused of something that you haven't done. And there's a tragedy in that, of course, because there are a lot of people who have tried to live good lives within the church. And there are a lot of people right now who are trying to live good lives within the church and whose ambition is to help people and to do, you know, what the basic tenets of Christianity are, which are, you know, just help your neighbor. And the tragedy of the Irish Catholic Church is that they've made that very difficult for people because there's an innate suspicion now because of what's happened and what's been revealed over the last sort of 50 years or so. Mm-hmm.
It was, the Catholic Church was a powerful force in Irish society for centuries, and even 30 years ago, Ireland was by far the most church-going country in Western Europe. And the sudden collapse of the church has certainly left a power vacuum in society. What do you think is taking its place?
Well, I think a good thing is that the government here has become a much more secular government, and that, you know, for many decades the church really ran the government, and that doesn't happen now. And we are, you know, I mean, as you possibly know, we're having a referendum here next month on same-sex marriage, on equality, and these are the kind of things that, you know, 20 years ago, I mean, you wouldn't have even imagined would happen. I mean, for that matter, homosexuality was only decriminalized in 1993 in Ireland. So, you know, it has changed in that way. I'm not sure what's taken its place. It's probably, you know, probably like in any country in the world, you know, we've become more selfish, I think, haven't we? And people look after themselves much more than after others. But, you know, whether that's the fault of the church or not, I'm not so sure. But there's certainly a vacuum for the idea of the concept of Christianity at its very basic heart, maybe not for the notion of organized religions themselves, but, you know, bringing back the notion of just kindness and decency and, you know, moving away from constant wars in every country and constant prejudice and bigotry. I mean, the prejudice we're listening to in Ireland at the moment because of this referendum is just horrifying at times. Yeah. And you just kind of think, oh, you know, roll on May 23rd when this is all over and you don't have to listen to it. You know, there's just a lack of kindness in the world, I think.
Statistics on child abuse, even though we, you know, they're unlikely to be completely reliable, but they usually indicate that female children are twice as likely to be sexually abused as male children. Yet the people who have come forward in the pedophilia revelations have been, I think, overwhelmingly male. First of all, is that true of Ireland as well? And why would that be? Was the structure of the church something that nourished the abusive behavior, particularly conducive to the abuse of boys and young men? And do you think maybe the girls and women simply haven't spoken up?
Well, what I found in Ireland is that the majority of cases here of girls being abused when children, their abuse has been committed by family members. And that's been pretty overwhelming, actually, particularly, I think, in more rural and more isolated areas. And there's been many cases of that documented here over the last 10, 15 years. In terms of the boys, the relationship between the church and the education system, the church and the altar boys, the fact that most schools are run by priests, left young boys in a very vulnerable position at times. Most girls in Ireland would generally have been educated by nuns. And while nuns have their own issues, certainly, and, you know, have a different story, perhaps a violent past or an uncaring past sometimes, nuns traditionally do not seem to move down the road of sexual abuse. They move down the road of physical abuse. That's a vast generalization in its way. But I just feel that young boys in Ireland have traditionally been around priests, and the church has never particularly welcomed women or girls into their environment anyway, you know, and priests have always just been interested in, you know, again, I can't say all priests, but it's been boys who have been mostly pursued by priests.
Okay, and there was you also something treated in your book, or at least mentioned and shown very well, is there was a pretty appalling misogyny on the part of some of the priests, certainly, in your book.
Well, yeah, and I mean, and that's part of society here, and that doesn't really change. It's got better, certainly, but I mean, worldwide, of course, the church has had a very, very negative view of women, I think, over the years.
Yes.
And doesn't welcome women into their congregation very much, despite the fact that, you know, everybody has a mother, and so, you know, that has filtered down in Ireland because the church ran the country so much. You know, like in Ireland, women couldn't even work after they got married until about 30 years ago. It was the law. You know, men really ruled things. We still haven't had a female prime minister. So there has been a history of that. But I would say that has improved a lot.
Now, Udren serves Pope John Paul I, whom a lot of people may not remember. His papacy lasted, I guess, about a month. And Udren doesn't believe that the Pope died of natural causes, and there are certainly hints at homicide by persons with financial motives, let's say. There was certainly a lot of speculation at the time. Is there some old juicy Vatican gossip that you picked up?
I suppose I read quite a few conspiracy theories when I was writing that section. And I wanted a part of the novel where Odin really got away from Ireland and experienced something else of the world. So I put him in that situation. And that those two chapters are probably closer in line to some of my previous books than the rest of the book is. I think there is a case to be made, certainly. And no one will ever know one way or the other. It's like it's like the Kennedy assassination. You know, no one ever is really going to know the absolute truth. But it did seem suspicious that a man who was relatively young, was in the peak of health, and was investigating criminal behavior in the financial side of the Vatican, suddenly died. Particularly when you look at the other people who were assassinated around Italy at the time, like, you know, the Prime Minister, and who was a very close friend of Paul VI. It seemed to have been quite a dark period. He may well have died of natural causes, but, you know, sometimes in the novel you have to have a little bit of fun.
Well, sure. Absolutely. Now, is there some special significance in the use of the name Odrun? It's an unusual name, isn't it?
It's unusual, and I've only ever known one Odrun in my life, but I wanted a name that would be his own name and no one else's. And I like the idea of using Yeats because of the poet Yeats, but of course I changed the spelling of it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I always think long and hard about names for books. You want it to sound right. You want it to feel original without being unnecessarily quirky. And the name just rang true to me.
Oh, it certainly works. What's next for you? What are you working on now?
Well, as you mentioned, I move back and forth between novels aimed at adults and novels for young readers. And I very much enjoy doing that. And my next book is a novel for young readers coming out in the UK in September and in the States, I think, early next year. It's called The Boy at the Top of the Mountain. And it's a novel set during the Second World War about a little boy, a little orphan, who is the nephew of the housekeeper at Hitler's mountainside retreat, the Berghof. Ah. And spends the war living there, watching how Hitler changes and how the war develops just from the mountaintop. So it's a companion piece in some ways to my earlier book, The Boy in the Striped Pajamas, in that it's exploring the Second World War through what I hope is an original perspective.
That sounds wonderful. Point of view is always very interesting, isn't it? Different points of view. All right, well, thank you very much. We've been talking with author John Boyne about his latest novel, A History of Loneliness. Thank you very much for joining us at the Washington Independent Review of Books.
Thank you.